Hello and welcome to Keanu Club, like a cool breeze over the mountains. This is episode 21, I Love You to Death, from 1990. We've entered the 1990s, finally! I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us today, very special guest, Lindsay Gibb. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi.
I think it's very fitting that you're on this movie, that you're talking about this movie, because this, in a lot of ways, sort of seems like a lost Cage Club movie.
Yeah.
You know, in ways. Like, I was talking to Mike, it feels like this lead role, like, if Kevin Kline said no, Nicolas Cage absolutely could have done this Kevin Kline role.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I could picture that. Though, when I was thinking about Cage when watching this, I was thinking more about the Keanu role, just because of how cagey that role is. It's a weird, weird role.
So this is the second time, right, Mike, that we've seen him as a hitman?
Yeah, Act of Vengeance, right?
Act of Vengeance, yeah, with Charles Bronson. This is another movie where I was just like, all right, where is he? And then he shows up, and unlike that movie where he's only on screen for 5 or 10 minutes, I mean, he's pretty much here for the whole second half of the movie.
Yeah, and a great entrance again. We thought his entrance in Parenthood was good, but somehow managed to top that.
And again, thinking about, you know, the Lost Cage Club, we have major characters introduced over a billiards table. And we have Keanu coming up and dropping this cue ball on the table for his cousin to shoot. This is such a Cage movie in all the best ways.
When you mentioned it to me earlier in the day, I was like, yeah, you could almost sense his spirit somewhere in here. I mean, there's room for him to be anywhere in this movie. I mean, even a new character. Yeah, I miss him.
Now, Lindsay, had you seen this movie before you signed up to do it?
Yeah, that's really why I picked it. I just really love this movie. In particular, I love Kevin Kline a lot. I feel like if I could write another book about an actor, maybe Kevin Kline would be worth it.
Really? All right.
So great.
I've liked other movies that we've done so far, but this is the first movie that was sort of like, that reminded me of the early Cage movies where it sort of came out of nowhere and I just loved it. It's one of those ones that I didn't know anything about, and I wasn't sure what to expect, and I just walked away loving this movie. It's just so weird and sort of silly. It's shot in a way, like, there's a thing that I read that the director and the cinematographer wanted to shoot it not like a comedy at all, because, like, it's really serious and, like, sort of dark stuff that they're doing. I don't know what it was. It grabbed me, and I love this movie.
It's so watchable in the same way that, like, Moonstruck is watchable. I find, like, I can just watch Moonstruck over and over because there's just so many different bits and pieces happening. And I feel like this movie is similar in that way, where there's, like, every character is really interesting, every little bit is hilarious, and there's just a lot of layers to it.
Well, I might be on my own then, whereas I didn't dislike or hate this movie, but I definitely, it took me a while to get into this, and not really until Keanu showed up could I really engage all the way with this movie, which was surprising for me because this was directed by Lawrence Kasdan, and, you know, aside from writing some of my favorite movies, he's directed stuff like Big Chill and Grand Canyon, and I almost thought it should have been shot more like a comedy. I was thinking maybe like Frank Oz or the Coen brothers should have made this movie, because I like the situation and the story and the murder plot. I like that whole thing, but I don't want to say it fell flat entirely, but it definitely took me a while to engage with this movie.
I don't know what it is about it. I'm glad that Lindsay brought up Moonstruck, because it feels like, I think just because it's these Italian Americans, right?
Yeah.
It feels like Johnny Canerari.
And the ensemble, I guess, aspect to it too.
Mm-hmm. What's weird about it, and I don't know if I missed it early on or whatever, but early on in the movie, Kevin Kline's watching like a Sonics game, like a Seattle Sonics, and I'm just like, that's weird, because like this movie definitely takes place in New York. And then later you see his car with the license plate, it's Washington State, and his license plate is Pizza Man, because he owns a pizzeria. But like it feels like it has this real sort of New York Italian vibe, and it's just set in Seattle. Like, and I'm not sure why that is, because we know that the Pacific Northwest can be shot to sort of look like anything, and this might have even been shot like in Vancouver, as we know with Lindsay's Canadian experience. There's a lot of things shot in Canada to make it sort of look like wherever, but like it has this New York vibe, and the fact that it's unabashedly in Seattle, it's sort of weird.
Yeah, I didn't really think about where it was. I guess the thing about Kevin Kline's character, he doesn't seem to have any family around him. It's more like her family is there, like her mom is there. So maybe he's transplanted from somewhere else. I don't know.
I think his mom does actually show up at the very end. And that threw me for a complete loop because I, like you, just assumed he was just a loner. You know, he had no family left. And yeah, I definitely thought this took place in New York as well. And I don't even think it's Seattle. I think it might even be Spokane, which is even sort of more remote. You know, it's a funnier sounding name than Seattle. Maybe that helped.
Kevin Kline plays this guy named Joey, great name, obviously, who owns a pizzeria. And his pizzeria is sort of like stacked with Hollywood talent. I mean, we just saw Tracy Ullman on the Tracy Ullman Show. She is his wife and a waitress. He's also got River Phoenix, who we talked about recently, brother of Leaf Phoenix, who we just saw in Parenthood. And he'll be in two future Keanu Club movies coming up in the next few years before he unfortunately passes away at the age of 23. Everybody that we need to know and care about until the Hitmen show up, Keanu and William Hurt, until they show up later, like everybody that we know and care about is really involved in this pizzeria. And so it's sort of like this really tight knit, and that's the whole thing, right? It's all about, you know, families and relationships and treating each other well and respecting one another, sort of.
Well, yeah, exactly. Sort of.
Or thinking that you should be doing that and you're not.
The whole movie starts with Kevin Kline's Joey confessing to his priest or whatever. And that part, from the beginning, I was howling laughing because I don't know, like there's nothing that I can even describe about that scene. Like he's just going through, oh, you know, I've cheated on my wife. And then he's trying to figure out the order in which and like how many people he's slept with and all of this stuff. But it's partially just his delivery and also the fact that he has the worst Italian accent, but it somehow works. I guess because it's a comedy, also probably just because it's Kevin Kline. It works so well.
I cheated on my wife.
You committed adultery?
Yes.
How many times?
Five times the last 2 weeks. Wait. No. That's wrong. It was four times this week with three women. And three times last week with two other women. Wow. Plus, one of the women from this week was the same as last week. Or maybe two of the women was the same. So I guess that makes, seven times? I mean, it was more than seven times, Father. It was more like 10 or 12 times. But, you know, it was like on seven different occasions, only with five different women, but some of the women more than once.
And I think that really does a good job of setting up, you know, basically the first act of the movie too, because you know that he's unfaithful and that's going to be what gets him into trouble. I definitely am a big fan of Kevin Kline. I don't know, maybe if it was the accent that took me a while to like. I mean, I don't know if he's necessarily even a very likable character, you come to learn, but it definitely took me a while to adjust to him doing the accent. And it was just another thing that reminded me now of Cage and, you know, Cage doing his Captain Corelli or something like that. But I definitely loved River Phoenix in this as Devo. You know, I thought that was a great name too. And I think he's just like a great contrast to the Kevin Kline character Joey also, where Joey is supposed to sort of embody, you know, masculinity and all of that kind of stuff. And then River Phoenix is sort of like this gentle soul of a man, a little younger, but just, I like the contrast that's going to play out between the characters.
And not only contrast between the characters in that sense, but also Joey not really faithful at all to his wife, and Devo probably a little bit too in love with Joey's wife. Even though we never really talk about it, that's sort of hinted at, and I think people ask him about it a little bit. I think even Joey asks him about it. You know what I mean? But like, it's sort of unspoken, but like he's in love with Tracy Ullman, right?
Oh yeah. Or at least totally devoted to her. Like he may not have any real romantic feelings towards her, but he just like completely loves her and thinks she's the best.
It contrasts so well because Kevin Kline, Joey, it's not that he doesn't love his wife. I think he just sort of takes her for granted. At one point early on in the movie, when we see him with one of his first people that he's like, quote unquote, fixing her pipes, because he also, in addition to owning his pizzeria, owns the building and sort of does maintenance work. And she asks him, if you're such a good Catholic, why do you commit adultery? He says, I'm a man. I got a lot of hormones in my body. And basically, it's just like, I just got to have sex with women. Like, that's just what I got to do. And it's not like he's like, my wife drives me crazy or anything, because it seems like they get along. It's just, he's just got a lot of hormones in his body.
Yeah, he keeps telling all the women, like Victoria Jackson, that who really seem to want to be with him permanently. He's like, no, I'm married. What are you thinking? Like, no, I love my wife.
It's an interesting dynamic, and it's kind of, it reminded me of just like very old school, almost Sopranos-esque, you know, like that tradition where it's like, yeah, you have your wife and then you have your side piece, you know, I don't see the problem with that is what they would say. So it's sort of like a stereotype and a trope, and I think it works well in the movie because they sort of use each of his girls in a way to set up comedic situations, like when he meets Phoebe Cates at the bar,
yeah,
and they go home. Like, yep. I thought that whole thing was great. Like, his whole speech there was fantastic, and the stuff with the dog at her house, and like later Heather Graham's gonna show up looking for a room, mm-hmm. and everything, you know. So
yeah,
it's just like this stereotype integrated really well, I think, into the story.
I noticed that Phoebe Cates wasn't credited in the movie, and they were married like the year that this was made. So I'm assuming that he just, you know, fought for her to be in the movie, and there she was.
Yeah, so I read about that he requested that Phoebe Cates take a small role in the film and did it as a cameo appearance and as a favor to Kevin Kline. And she was also filming Drop Dead Fred at the same time. So apparently she has like the same hairdo in both movies, which is because she was just sort of like, I guess, kind of moonlighting as this cameo role for probably like 2 days or whatever she was on set.
Yeah, I think she really jumped off screen. I totally forgot that they were married, and it's kind of sad that she didn't like come back later. And I think maybe that's maybe my one sort of thing about this is like a lot of things are just kind of dropped, you know, like there's just a lot of, they don't feel like skits necessarily, but there's like set pieces in this, and they just feel like we're going to just see a character for the moment and they're never going to really come back aside from our main cast. And that's not like necessarily a big problem. It's just I was just sort of expecting this to all be set up, but it's more just to get like a tight grip on the Joey character and where he's coming from and that side of the story, I guess.
Yeah, I think that kind of works because it's sort of how mm-hmm. he treats them, too. Like, you know, he just sort of picks them up and, like, drops them and then doesn't go back to them. Or, you know, if he happens to run into them again, like, you know, if she calls for another time that her pipes are broken or whatever, he'll go take care of that. But, like, he's not actively seeking out an affair with any of these girls. He's just doing it because he can. And so the movie, as such, is sort of like, well, if he's just doing it because we can, like, we don't have to go back to him. Like, as much as I would sort of like to see if they figured out a way to do it funny, like, have Phoebe Cates return, like, I'm satisfied with her role in the film. I don't necessarily need to go back and see what she's up to. Or plus, I think also, like, we don't want to see all these women just, like, clamoring for him, right? It's not like he's, like, this irresistible catch.
He charmed Phoebe Cates, who was there with somebody and seemed completely uninterested in him until he started sort of wooing her.
You know what? I know something about you.
Yeah, what do you know about me?
I know you've never been in here before in your life.
Really? How do you know that? Maybe I have.
No, if you'd been in here, I would have known about it. People would have talked about it. Like, hey, Joy, you see what was in here the other night? My God, what a beauty. It's true. No. Someone like you doesn't come around that often. It's like a national holiday. You know what I mean? You don't forget it.
If he has no intention of staying with any of these women, he'll go back to the ones who are, like, easy to access, I guess. Like, the ones who live in his building. But otherwise, he just moves on.
I guess what threw me is I sort of was expecting a whole different movie, which is maybe why I should rewatch this again. Like, I almost thought this was going to be entirely taking place at the pizzeria. He'd be juggling all of his affairs, and then somewhere in the second act, they'd all get together and form some sort of girlfriend club, and they'd all then, like, get revenge on him somehow. But the movie doesn't go that way at all. It's much more of a dark comedy than something like that that might be more slapstick.
Yeah, if you want to see that, just go watch The Other Woman from a couple years ago with Jamie Lannister in it. I mean, that's that movie, and that movie did not turn out well. It's this, you know, it's all the affairs finding out about each other. But what I do like is that, like Lindsay just said, that the girls he goes back to over and over again are the ones, the convenient ones, the ones that live in his building, which I think is why it's funny if you think about it. And I didn't think about this when watching it, but now thinking about it now, is that, you know, maybe he and Heather Graham sip Miss McGill's tea together or whatever, and he really enjoyed it, and then he's like, hey, you know, I got an apartment, like, why don't you move in the building? So, like, I like that this idea that all the girls that he really, really likes has them move into the building so that it's convenient for them to sort of sleep with
them. It's almost like he's collecting them in a way or something, and it might also explain why when they hear gunshots, they don't call the police later in the movie. They're just like, oh, Joey's getting what's coming to him.
another cameo, sort of, except there's no way that you would really recognize it unless, like, I had to look it up. But Shiri Appleby, who was in Girls and who's now the star of Unreal, which I can't believe I'm saying this, but, like, one of the best shows on TV right now is on Lifetime Network. Shiri Appleby plays this, like, this 12-year-old girl who comes up to Tracy Ullman in the park when she's crying. So, like, it's weird that we see, like, a really young Heather Graham. We see Phoebe Cates a little bit older than we saw her in Fast Times for Cage Club. And we have this really, really young Shiri Appleby showing up. So this movie's sort of like a crossroads for a lot of different actors and a lot of different things that, aside from River Phoenix, don't really have anything to do with Keanu, but sort of a lot of our other interests in the world.
Yeah, Lawrence Kasdan movies always seem to have, like, at least his best movies always seem to have, like, a really great ensemble cast. Like, if you look at, like, The Big Chill, right? Like, I mean, William Hurt's in that too. So is Kevin Kline. You know, there's just lots of people that went on to be big. And Grand Canyon, you got, like, Danny Glover and Steve Martin, and that's also another ensemble thing. And, yeah, I just think the cast here works. Like, there's a lot of chemistry going on, especially when the movie gets going in the second act, you know, when after Tracy Ullman finds out for sure, after hearing it for what seems like months and months, that she actually catches Kevin Kline at the library. I feel like once that happens, for me, the movie really ramps up a level and everybody starts bouncing off each other really well.
And also, speaking of cameos, we have Lawrence Kasdan himself as River Phoenix's lawyer a little bit later in the movie. And we also have the screenwriter I read. I don't know what he looks like, but we have the screenwriter as a patron in the pizza restaurant. So there's always, like, little cameos that not only are they people that we know from other movies, but also just sort of fun, like, hey, like, why don't you just go in this movie for a little bit? What we did for Parenthood, what I really appreciated about the Parenthood episode, is we talked a lot about Keanu and his role, and I want to get to that. But before we get there, I just like this movie so much that, like, I don't mind talking about things that aren't just Keanu based, because I just like this movie. But what I like is that, you know, on one of his trips out of the home to repair the pipes of someone in the building, Tracy Ullman has a line that says, "I can never get you to fix anything at home," which I think is really funny because she doesn't know the full implications or ramifications of what he's doing. And so she's just like, "Why don't you fix anything around here?" And she's like, "Well, you don't really know exactly what he's doing." What I like about her is that she's written in a way that she's super naive. Like, she doesn't realize what's going on until she catches him in the act, but it doesn't come off as stupid. And I'm not sure how that's done, but, like, it's respectful in a way that she should obviously know what's going on, but she just, like, has faith in her husband and loves her husband. And I don't know why it works, but it works. And I'm not sure if either of you have an idea of how that happens.
Yeah, I guess it's just a testament to Tracy Ullman. I'm not really sure how she swings it either.
I'd say for me, the weakest part of this movie, and sorry, you guys are loving it so much, and I do like it, I'm just not praising it, you know, but I think the weak thing for me is kind of the script and some of this dialogue and a little bit of the situation they have to kind of feels like they have to force these characters through a few doors to get them into the room they want them to be in. But I just think everybody is such a good actor, and we got a good director that she's pulling it off, like, really well. Because I was thinking the same thing, Joe. I was like, this kind of feels like it shouldn't work, but I'm buying it entirely.
I don't know why it hooked me, but, like, if it didn't hook me, I would also be like, well, why is she in the library? Like, why are any of them in the library? You know what I mean? Like, why is he in the library, like, with this girl? Like, why are they making out in public? Why is she in the library returning things? If I was sort of not on board with this movie, I would have problems like that too. But just for whatever reason, because it worked,
there was something about the library that actually helped me get on board a little more, to be honest, because I was, okay, this is something dated. This is truly, you know, 1990. You had to go to the library, and, like, people just kind of hung out there, met other people, you know. There was no internet. There's none of that kind of stuff. So I was kind of like, wow, he probably just trolls the library picking up chicks. Like, that might be one of his spots to go to. You never know. And that's where Tracy Ullman goes, because she's a reader, and to save money, you have a library card.
I mean, I work in a library. People still go to libraries, guys. But yes.
But do you have people, like, setting up secret trysts at the library?
Who knows? I work in a university library, so yeah, probably.
But it's also at the library that when Tracy Ullman catches him in the act of just kissing this girl, that things set in motion. Because I think at one point her mom asked her, like, what would you do if you ever found Joey cheating on you? And she said, well, I would kill him and then kill myself. Like, it would be devastating. And then she sees him kissing. So she tells her mom, and the two of them sort of hatch this murder plot.
Yeah, it's apparently based on a true story. Now, the extent to which I mean, it's probably just based on the fact that someone tried to kill her husband for cheating on her. That's about the entirety of the story.
This kind of feels like another Italian thing where it's just the overreaction quality of their emotions and relationships and stuff. Just the idea of the wife finding out and, you know, I'm not going to kill him and actually kill him. I thought that was funny that they play that out. And I also started feeling a little more Moonstruck-esque just in the sense that this gets kind of operatic, even though there's a weird lack of music, like the actual like the plot and the story and the way that it becomes like this murder plot and this like impossible to achieve murder plot too. I really fell into that, and I liked the comedy they were going for with that.
I don't know if it's a tragedy through the lens of comedy or comedy through the lens of tragedy, but in the end, like, everything sort of works out, so it's not really a tragedy at all. So I guess it's just sort of a comedy dressed up in tragedy clothes. But talking about how it's based on a true story, I don't know why I made this decision in the opening credits. Maybe just the way that the based on true story sort of came up in like this weird sort of word art font that spun around. But like from the very beginning, you know, Mike, you mentioned them earlier, I got like a Fargo vibe. I'm just like, I have the sense this is, you know, even though this is based on a true story, like it's not really based on a true story. Like it might be based on like a headline somewhere, like somebody hearing about it and then just sort of going out on their own. I was on board for sort of like a suspension of disbelief, not worrying about reality or anything like that. And so I was on board.
I guess back when I watched this years and years ago, I read up on the true story, and it was a woman who repeatedly tried to kill her husband and then ended up going to jail for 4 years for attempted murder because she never succeeded. So that's where the comedy aspect comes from, is the fact that she probably in real life, she just kept trying to kill him. Whereas in this, it's like, yeah, she keeps trying to kill him, but it's all in one night. And so it's, yeah, poison him, shoot him, get someone else to shoot him. None of it works.
Joey in this movie is almost like Rasputin to them.
Totally.
And so the first murder plot that they have, and I think it's four or five, and we'll count as we go along, but the first one is they just hire a guy that the mom is friends with some woman whose grandson they hire. And the only reason he's going to do it is because his grandma is friends with Tracy Ullman's mom. And what I thought about, funny, a little bit of foreshadowing for a couple episodes down the line, he shows up in an Abraham Lincoln mask. I'm like, that's a dead president's mask. It's all blending together into one universe.
Yeah, and not only that, maybe some backshadowing, is that a term? But the Brotherhood of Justice used to dress up and terrorize their town. They had a couple of president masks on as well.
Those masks are always going to be part of Keanu Club, forever and ever. He just sort of panics and he runs away and nothing happens. And this being a comedy, Kevin Klein just sort of chalks it up to nothing really happening. Right?
Well, he buys a gun after that, right? And Tracy Ullman's like, great, now he's going to be able to defend himself. It's going to be that much harder to kill him. But he only buys like a 22, and that, you know, they use it on him later. It's not very useful.
They say in the movie it doesn't pack enough of a punch, that it's just like this tiny little gun that just literally it grazes him and like goes through his chest and like doesn't do anything. And then murder plot number two, the mom, who apparently is good with cars, which I don't know if we see that before this point, but she's good with cars and she tries to plant a car bomb. And then Tracy Ullman gets in the car with him to go to work. And this is something that, like, I got the sense, if this was like Moonstruck, like, I just sort of, for some reason, thought that they lived above the pizzeria, but they don't. It doesn't make sense that they don't live near the pizzeria, but whatever. And they're going to drive to work, and so the mom's freaking out that, you know, not only is she going to successfully kill Joey, but she's also going to kill her daughter, and then the car bomb just doesn't work.
Yep.
And then murder plot number three is they're going to make him a bowl of spaghetti, and they put two entire bottles of sleeping pills in there. And not only does it not kill him, but he says to them that it's the best spaghetti sauce that he's ever eaten or the best spaghetti that he's ever had. And so not only do they not kill him, but like it's almost like they're helping out this guy that they actively want to murder.
Because he eats so much of it because he likes it so much. He just keeps mopping up the sauce with the bread, and it's crazy the amount of sauce that he eats and doesn't die.
Yeah, it almost seems to fuel him in a way, like give him more power, like keep him from sleeping in a way.
It's important how much he eats, as we'll learn a little bit later, because it's because he basically ingests so much sleeping pills that the bleeding when he does get shot later, spoiler alert, that the bleeding does not bleed him out. So, like, it works. And that's another thing. Like, the movie just sort of, in this weird, bizarre, crazy, heightened logic world that it's in, it all still makes sense. Like, they still have things that set up to pay off later. So even if you're not necessarily on board, I think it works as a script in that regard.
Yeah, I think, again, too, once this whole murder plot gets going, that's when I'm really into it. And it made me think of The Prince of Pennsylvania, Joey, because in that movie, you know, there's like 20, 30 minutes left and he decides to kidnap his father. And we kept talking about, no, that should have happened 20, 30 minutes into the movie. So yeah. When they commit to the murder stuff, you know, I'm like, yes, now I know for the rest of the film what I'm dealing with, and I can just kind of sink into it. And there's one scene that really did it for me too. It was like a transitional scene in a way where she finds out that her husband's cheating and she goes home and she takes the sleeping pills, and it kind of goes from suicide to divorce to let's murder him, all in the span of like this little conversation with her mother. And then I was like, okay, for me, I was like, the movie has begun.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a simple thing. That's what makes me so mad about like movies like The Prince of Pennsylvania, because like the whole point of that movie, in a sense, is the kidnapping plot, and it doesn't get going until after an hour. Here, the whole point is that, you know, she's going to kill him, and it's such a simple thing. Like, this is now the second act of the movie. Just the fact that they put it at the right timing makes all the difference.
Before we get to where Keanu comes in, I have to admit that I picked this movie because I loved it, but I had no memory of Keanu being in it. I knew that he was because it was one of the movies in your list, but I had to rewatch it to see who he was. And wow.
This was another movie, and we've had it a few times. And obviously, I know what Keanu Reeves looks like, but it's also one of those things where, like, he's not in it for 45 minutes. I'm just like, I didn't miss him, right? Like, it's not like he was, like, in a cameo in a scene where, like, I looked down when I was taking notes or something, and like, I looked up and he was gone. But then I looked at the list, and, like, you know, he's, like, sixth or seventh build. And I'm like, how are we not there yet? How are we not to William Hurt yet? Like, where are they? Like, how? What is going on?
Yeah, I expected, because they had such similar names, Harlan and Marlon James, that we were going to get them together. So I was just kind of waiting for the two of them to arrive.
And these guys are going to be in the rest of the movie. They can't kill Joey on their own, so they finally have to hire somebody again to do it. This time they hire two people instead of one person. I was also, where's Keanu? And when he shows up, I just truly feel like he doesn't disappoint one day.
Oh, no.
Not at all.
Oh, actually, before we get to him, I do want to mention murder plot number four is that they have River Phoenix come over and they take Joey's gun while he's passed out from all the sleeping pills, and they have him shoot or try to shoot him. And it just sort of, I guess we find that at the very end of the movie, right? It kind of grazes his head, like sort of behind his ear a little bit. He's like, I think I hit him, but it's nothing more than just like an attempt.
Yeah, and that was, he like closes his eyes, right? And or he says he didn't look when he shoots. And I just felt really bad for his character because, like I mentioned earlier, like he's someone who would never hurt a fly, but because he's in love with Tracy Ullman, he'll do anything she says. So he's willing to finish off the murder for her. But he's completely incompetent in that part. So total failure.
And then he can't do it again. He's like, he needs to be shot again, but I can't be the one to.
You're gonna have to shoot him again.
No, I can't. I can't believe I did it the first time. I can't believe you let me do that.
Well, then if you can't do it, then you'll have to find someone who can. I'll put up the money. We need professionals. This has to be done right away.
Oh, you know someone?
I need to collect myself.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, he's just like a 20-year-old kid. You're basically saying, hey, kid, kill your boss, kill my husband because he cheated on me. And she's like, all right, like, I guess, you know, I'm kind of in love with you, so I guess?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's a lot to ask of anybody, let alone
one of my favorite characters now that we're talking about it is the mother, Tracy Ullman's mother. She's almost like the mob boss. She's like, with River Phoenix, come on, like, do it. Like, what's wrong? You know, so, like, she's always sort of there on the shoulder. If Tracy Ullman can't get him to do whatever she needs him to, the mother's there, too.
Well, she sort of knows that, like, business needs to get done, right? We can't be messing around. We gotta
take him out.
Yeah,
she seems very old school, too, almost from the old world, even. That's how we used to do things.
So after murder plot number four fails, they go to this bar and we find Harlan James and his cousin Marlon at the billiards table like we talked about before. And this is sort of, it's similar in a way that we talked about a lot with the Parenthood episode, Mike, where it's the same kind of character in a sense of this like burnout stoner slacker guy. But it's like they saw what he's done before and like, all right, we're going to amplify this like three levels higher. We're going to just make him like super, super out there, really, really dumb. But like it works. And I think it works so beautifully because we've seen him in the role, and this is sort of like an extension or an elaboration of the role, but also he has like William Hurt to bounce off of, and like this partnership works really well, I think, in terms of setting up this character for
comedic effect.
These guys
are like the demented Bill and Ted, right? Like the Bill and Ted heroin addicts instead of guitar enthusiasts.
Right.
And I think Keanu is still typecast to a degree, but what works is, you know, everything I think up until this point has been PG or PG-13, and this time he gets to go R-rated, so he can be a junkie, he can take that persona darker, and I think it's great.
And maybe at this point I was just looking for Cage connections, but he reminded me of Max California, which also, you know, from 8mm, which is Joaquin Phoenix, and so we have the brother River Phoenix, but he's just sort of this, like, this beautiful stoner who's, like, embedded in this seedy underbelly of a world, and just visually he kind of looks like him, and I don't know, I'm not sure if that's my brain kind of playing tricks on me, that that's not actually the case, or if you guys want to back me up. That's just what it reminded me of.
I definitely remember 8mm. I think River Phoenix had a few more tats on him, but aside from that,
I mean, Joaquin
I think
Phoenix,
Joaquin
Phoenix.
Had a few more tats on him and may have been a little more lucid more of the time than Keanu, but they're definitely rocking that same type of edgy look. His hair, I think, is left over from Parenthood in a way. That's what I was thinking, because in Parenthood, remember, they sort of shave each other's hair a little bit, and we were kind of wondering if maybe he was wearing a wig in that, but now I'm thinking, okay, I took it there in Parenthood, let's like carve up my hair even more in this one and make it look like I might have just had brain surgery or something. I don't know. He's really out there.
Yeah, he's got some weird patchy spots on his head. It's a very interesting, to say the least, haircut.
My only note about Keanu in this was that I loved his hair. It is. I haven't seen Parenthood in a long time, so I didn't realize that there might be a connection with the hair. But yeah, for sure. It's like shaved underneath in like weird spots, and then it's long on top. And he's got a nose ring.
Yeah.
And a weird beard. Yeah, it's great.
It's terrific.
And like when he's introduced, River Phoenix goes into the bar in disguise and he's like wearing a Fu Manchu mustache and glasses. And the bartender's like, yeah, it's you, Devo. Just like they're waiting for you in the back. I thought that was really funny. And William Hurt is passed out on the pool table and Keanu kind of crawls up from underneath with the ball and places it down. And, you know, that whole little moment there was just perfect for me. I was really, at this point, I was like, all right, these guys are great. I'm glad they're around and I hope they stick around the rest of the movie.
And luckily for us, as opposed to other times where, you know, we've had characters that we love come and go, they're here to stay, that they're offered $300 to kill a man. And it doesn't seem like a whole lot. I think they negotiated up to like $400 or no, $500. But I mean, even that, like, they're such like low rent criminals that of course they're not going to get the job done. Like if you're only willing to spend a couple $100, like kill somebody, you know, you're not exactly hiring the best of the best here.
I'll tell you, we'll do it for $600.
$400. He's practically got one foot in the grave.
$550, what do you say?
If we're gonna waste the dude, we ought to get paid for it, man. That's the American way, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're not communists here, you know. We're Americans, we got a right to make a living.
$500, that's my final offer.
Yeah, and they don't know what they're doing because they admit when they're at the house that they've never done this before.
Yeah, it's almost like they just heard job and money and they didn't even hear anything else. And then once they got there, I was like, oh, this is what we're going to be doing here. But that negotiation scene, Joey, reminds me of the night before where he's high on something and he's negotiating to sell his prom date and he keeps going up and down and up and down. I mean, Keanu in his movies has not been a great negotiator. We'll wait till Speed to see how that turns out, negotiating with him. But so far, no good.
They sort of confer. Keanu confers with William Hurt, and what I love about that, like, they do this at least two times, maybe more than two times, but like they have this great discussion, and William Hurt's like, "All right, go ahead and tell him," and just Keanu just says, "Okay, we'll do it." But like they have like this grand,
right.
You know, should we do this? Like we don't hear what they're saying, but like you know, they're weighing the pros and cons, just like, okay, like it's always just okay.
Yeah, I really think the two of these guys do have good chemistry, even though I think they're a few years apart in age. You know, there seems to be a generation gap between them. I'm not sure. But they have this good bit where Keanu keeps forgetting the name of the guy they're trying to kill. Like, I love that because William Hurt's just like, you know, the guy, and he still doesn't get it. When they show up at the house in a cab and they start walking in the wrong direction and they have no idea where they are half the time, and yet they come into the room and try to act like everything is totally normal, but William Hurt's like knocking his head on the chandelier. I mean, these guys are just, I'm loving everything they're doing. I almost want them to show up in more movies the way like Jay and Silent Bob show up in other movies.
Yeah, they're kind of like the Coen brothers characters in this.
Yeah, absolutely. What's great is that the world that the movie inhabits is like this bizarre world where like things are heightened, obviously. But everybody else aside from them is sort of grounded. I mean, the fact like what they're doing is crazy, but they're all like normal characters. And these two weirdos come in and they just like, you know, find the Reggie Jackson bat and they start chanting Reggie. That. And then from like, outside the room, if you're not watching what they're doing and like just sort of hearing through muffled walls like what they're talking about, it's just like oh, they want reggae music. Like everybody's just trying to make sense of what's going on, and like nothing makes sense because they're just like the world that they're from is so different than the world that everybody else lives in.
That Joan Plowright is looking for something to play, and then River Phoenix is like, they want reggae. They're calling for reggae. What's reggae?
Look at that.
What?
That's a Reggie Jackson model.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Reggie.
I love Reggie.
Oh, me too, man. He's the greatest.
Reggie.
They want to hear reggae music.
Reggae?
Yes.
There is. It's right here somewhere. I know it is.
I'll be waiting outside.
Why?
Because I can't stand this anymore.
I do like the way this movie increasingly gets out of control and crazy. River Phoenix is sort of doing the weirdest stuff so far, but then once the plot passes him in bizarreness and craziness and lunacy, that all comes to the head where we can't kill the husband. Then you can introduce characters like the cousins because the story has gone so crazy and we're with it that we can now bring in these crazy larger-than-life characters and it won't feel as out of place. In fact, for me, it felt totally natural and something that I almost wish happened a little sooner.
Well, I guess what works is that Tracy Ullman and her mom are such suburban mothers that they are out of their depth when it comes to something like hiring murderers. And so when you get people like William Hurt and Keanu Reeves showing up who are totally not murderers, they're just drug addicts that need some money.
They're just the closest exactly, thing that this like, town has to
murderers. You brought these dangerous people into my house, but they're just people who are going to get excited about a Reggie Jackson baseball bat. And anybody who was a little bit more savvy about anything like this, who'd been in any kind of dark situations before, would be like, I don't know if these guys know what they're doing, but these guys are like, oh, give them the reggae music that they want.
They're out of their depth there, but like they can't even get like the reggae music right. Like she doesn't put the music on until after the gunshot. They're in the room for like what must be 10 minutes. Like they're in there talking about baseball. They're in there, you know, saying the Pledge of Allegiance or like what they think is the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America
and to the republic
and
under
to the
one invisible nation,
nations under God, whose
spacious skies and amber and graves of liberty for all would
deliver us from freedom.
There's so much time for the grandma to like pick literally anything to put on the record player, and she still can't do that right. She has like the easiest part to play. Like basically, you brought in these quote unquote experts from outside to take care of their job. And you can't even do the one thing you need to do right just to sort of muffle up the sound. It's almost like their stupidity or Keanu's stupidity is infecting the world around.
I think she was looking for the Johnny Mathis records, which was taking so long too. But I totally love the detail where they're like, oh, we're going to kill this guy. Do you think we should say the Pledge of Allegiance or something? Like just that moment, you know, it completes their characters. It just makes them feel like they knew what they were playing so well. I just totally love these guys.
And so they shoot him, and this is, I guess, failed murder attempt number 5? And they actually do shoot him. It goes through his chest, and we find out later that he has a gunshot wound and an exit wound. Like, the bullet, like, went through him. But they're like, of course he's dead. Like, what do you think? And they're all drinking to the dead man. They're all sort of, they have, like, a some kind of European, like, what nationality are they? Like, Ukrainian or something?
Yeah.
She's saying something, you know, some kind of cheers or toast or whatever. And then Keanu's just like, oh, that's cool. Like, he has no idea what's being said. He's just like, oh, I'm going to roll with a bunch. He's like, that's pretty cool.
What should we drink to?
Here's to joy. Nekomu bogdusha prosti.
Nekomu bogdusha prosti.
That's cool.
Yeah, I think Tracy Ullman does start freaking out a little, though. Doesn't she start immediately regretting having killed him?
Yeah, because she starts crying.
And it's like right at that moment that Kevin Kline, like, appears downstairs in the living room wondering what's going on.
Because you know he's not going to die in this movie, but, like, even if he were to die, like, you know he's not going to die at the hands of these two buffoons. Like, they can't do anything, right? Like, how are they going to be able to kill
somebody
properly?
I mean, it's so ridiculous that people are having so much trouble killing a man who's laying immobile in bed. Like, he's not a hard target.
What also is great is that the gunshot actually woke him up. It, like, yeah, startled him out of his sleep. He didn't even feel it, but he just wanted to know what that noise was. It's crazy.
And he's so out of it because he had two bottles of sleeping pills in his system. And he's like, do I know everybody? And he's introducing himself to the killers. And the family's like, are you guys going to get out of here? Like, before we'll figure this out. And they chase Keanu and William Hurt out. But it's not the last time we're going to hear from them. But, like, they're sort of gone for a minute. River Phoenix gives them $200 because he's like, you only wounded him. Like, what good is that? And Keanu's just like, they have that another one of those little conferences, and Keanu's just like, okay, like, that's fair. Like, we didn't do the job we were going to do. But then maybe the line of the movie is that as they're walking out of the house, William Hurt says to Keanu, next time we do this, we get paid in advance, meaning, you know, next time somebody hires us to kill someone, we're going to get the money up front. And Keanu just says, if we keep shooting Joey, don't you think he might get suspicious? Like, just such a dumb dumb.
I remembered his name.
Next time we do this, we're going to get paid in advance.
If we keep shooting Joey, don't you think he might get suspicious?
Yeah, really.
He's always like, who's Joey?
That's true.
It seems like every time he opens his mouth in this movie, it's just gold.
Well, when they walk out of the house, too, it's great because they walk out together, they say those lines, and then they go in completely different directions, but, like, more like Keanu doesn't know where he's going. He's just wandering off in a different direction.
But also, like, they took a cab there, so they're not walking out to a car. Like, where are they going?
Yeah, it's just so true to their characters.
And then we cut to the police station where there's this guy saying, oh, you know, Harlan and his cousin Marlon, like, they're down at the bar saying that they got paid $5,000 to kill this guy, to kill Joey, and that they're just buying everybody drinks. So, like, I like that nothing about these characters make any sense in the best ways. They got less money than they were supposed to get, yet they're saying that they got more money, and they're, like, wasting the money that they do have just to sort of earn, like, fleeting goodwill. Like, there's such idiots, but, like, it's also wonderfully perfect.
It's the American dream.
To buy around at the bar and just sort of be loved and admired for one night. And so the detectives now show up to the house, then they want to see Joey, but the family's trying to chase him away because even though he's not dead, he's laying in bed with, like, a bullet hole and another bullet grazing and, you know, doped out of his mind on sleeping pills, and, like, that's not good.
So they have convinced him that he has a virus, so when the cops do go upstairs, he does say, oh, I have a virus. But...
And I love how the cop was like, oh my god, you should be in a hospital. Like, you're dying. It's so great when an outsider has finally come into this situation and reacted properly for once, you know? He's like, get this man into a hospital immediately. Get all these people in prison.
Well, because, like, these guys haven't been infected by the stupidity of Keanu Reeves. Like, they haven't interacted with him, so they're not tarnished by, like, the terrible stupidity of Harlan and Marlon.
Yeah, these guys are actually good cops, we learn. Early in the scene where they, you know, where it seems everybody in the opening scene, just, like, everyone in town goes to that pizzeria for lunch because they're hopping and they're just always so busy. But the cops come in and they're like, hey, good job catching the guy who's robbing all those 7-Elevens. Thanks for being out there. And they're like, you know what? It feels good to be appreciated. These guys are kind of set up early on to be normal, you know, like competent people, the most realistic.
Isn't one of the cops, I just remember this now, isn't one of the cops like the only one who realizes that the drawing that Kevin Kline's son drew was a flower and not a pizza? like they're just very good at what they do. I mean, going back to Cage Club, the only like really smart cops we had sort of the entire run were from Gone in 60 Seconds. Yeah. Like we're much quicker to smart cops here than having to wait, you know, 40 movies or whatever to get to that in Cage Club.
I'm surprised it's a pretty small leap from Prince of Pennsylvania, where you had like the entire Pennsylvania police force going into the mine that's about to explode, and then, you know, just a few short movies later, we have some of the most competent cops in film history, it seems. So.
And so they rush Kevin Kline off to the hospital, and everybody gets arrested. And then what's great is that Tracy Ullman's like trying to explain what happened, and like just like we're trying to recap on here, she's not even sure. Like, was that the first time he got shot, or was that the second time he got shot? She's like, hold on, like I gotta backtrack. Like, okay, so he hired those guys, and like, I mean, we talked about like there's been five failed murder attempts, and like she's trying to make sense of it, just as the cops trying to make sense of it.
The of all these people is that each of them are trying to take the blame for it. The grandmother, Joan Plowright, she's trying to say, oh, I did it. My daughter didn't do it. And then River Phoenix is trying to protect Tracy Ullman by being like, I did it, she didn't do it. And then she's protecting both of them by saying, no, I'm the one who shot him, they didn't do it.
I don't really want to see any of these characters go to jail either. Having just seen them all try and murder someone, I actually, you know, they built up a lot of empathy in that first act from me to be on their side for most of the movie. And the other weird thing is, I was kind of like, I think it was Kevin Kline in the first act, just being like his character, the womanizer and all that, I was kind of put off. But having seen him try to be murdered for an hour or so also gets me on his side by the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I'm on everybody's side here at the end, which is why when they all kind of reconcile, I buy it. I reconcile with them.
Yeah, you're happy that they all forgive each other.
And there's a great line where, like, again, like this, we were talking about it earlier, I think, that Carlin and Marlon are in jail, and Keanu's like, who's Joey? And then William Hurt's like, the guy. He's like, oh, yeah, the guy. Like, the whole last 12 hours of their life or whatever, and the whole last 45 minutes of the movie, like, he does not remember the simplest of details. You know, you were just charged to kill a guy, and you would think that this would leave, like, a lasting impression on someone. Like, either whether you were successful or failed, you're going to remember the guy you were supposed to kill.
And
he meets him
and shakes his hand and stuff and is like, who is that? Oh, the guy we just tried to kill. And then he walks into a door.
Hey, wow. How you doing?
I'm okay.
Who is this?
You bailed us out.
Yeah, I bail out everybody. I want to make a new start. Wipe the slate clean.
I hear they may charge us with attempted murder.
No. I'm not going to prosecute. See, if I prosecute you, they're going to put Rosalie in jail, too. I don't want that. No, without me, they got no case. Don't worry.
Hey, you know what happened? It wasn't personal or anything.
Yeah, right. I mean, we didn't even know you or anything.
Yeah. We weren't friends or anything, like now.
No. It wasn't the best way to meet.
We better get out of here, you know, before they change their mind.
Yeah, right.
Oh, what a nice guy.
Yeah.
Who's Rosalie?
I like that little meeting there moment at the end where he's meeting his murderers and all that. I really buy that Kevin Kline's character is like, oh, man, like, I almost died from all of my bullshitting around, you know? Like, I really do feel like I need to stop this shit and be faithful to my wife. And it's so strange that he becomes friends with his assassins and stuff. I don't know. I like that at the end. I just feel like that's a difficult moment, and it really came across naturally.
The reason that he doesn't press charges is because he loves Rosalie, right? Lindsay, do you remember reading what happened to after the woman in real life tried to kill her husband over like a series of time or whatever?
I think
like,
they didn't stay together, did they? But she did go to
love,
prison.
True love
because
wins.
I don't think you can say I don't press charges against someone who tried to kill me. I think
right.
The cops will be like, we don't care if you want to press charges. This person can't get away with trying to kill you. But they are, or at least at the time of this movie, because the attempts at murder happened in 83, and when this movie came out, articles started coming out about the real couple, and they call them the happy couple of I Love You to Death, so they were still married at that point in time.
It's just so weird that we've seen Keanu in prison, Joey. You know, you mentioned even episodes ago, it was already a lot. Like, it almost seems like every other movie he's going to wind up in jail, and here he is again at the end of this movie, even though he gets released, but another time behind bars.
And then I think his last line of the movie, after Kevin Kline's like, you guys can go, like, I'm not going to be pressing charges, he says, I bailed out everybody, I want to make a new start, wipe the slate clean. And then he's like, because I love Rosalie, I'm in love with Rosalie, I don't want to press charges on her. And then as they're walking out, Keanu's just like, Keanu not only walks straight into a door on the way out, but it's just like, who's Rosalie? Like, does not remember Joey, but also does not remember Rosalie. Just perfect.
I'm reading about the real people.
Okay, yeah.
I thought I would tell you. She tried to have him killed 5 times. The last time, he was shot in the head and chest. And then while he lay wounded for 5 days in their bed at home, she tried to poison him with chicken soup that was laced with barbiturates. It's basically,
I mean, what a premise for a comedy.
I'd like to see the dark, stark, and serious version of this now and get the Oscar bait version of this happening. It's almost like the last 20 minutes of Act of Vengeance.
Where the murders are successful and just everybody goes to jail. Oh, that's depressing. But yeah, so the way that Kevin Kline sort of rationalizes that he doesn't want to press charges, that he says that his wife loves him so much, she'd rather kill me than see me with another woman. She'd go to prison, she loves me so much. And so they get back together, and River Phoenix is a little bit bummed. I guess in River Phoenix's world, you know, Kevin Kline gets killed, they get off scot-free, and then he's able to sort of swoop in on Rosalie, right?
Yeah, that's what I was imagining was going on in the back of his mind is, yeah, I got to see this through to the end, because the chances are if we get away with it, I can get away with her.
I feel like we haven't really had a best ending yet in Keanu Club. I mean, we've had, like, satisfying endings, but I don't think we've really had one that we, like, mm-hmm. you know, like, there's nothing like Birdie where just, like, that's, like, the perfect crazy way to end the movie. But here we have the perfect closing line. They're talking, like, well, what happens if he cheats again? Just like, well, we'll kill him.
You think Joey can be faithful to her?
Anything is possible. They get me a box of candy.
What if he isn't?
We shoot him again. Just kidding.
Like, that's just like, you know, we tried to do it once, like, we didn't get in trouble. Like, we'll just do it again.
30 years later. Let's bring the whole cast back together. Mm. Yeah, well, most of the cast. Let's bring the surviving cast back together and see what kind of hijinks they can get into this time.
Yeah, forget Bill and Ted 3. Let's do I Love You to Death 2. So a couple things quickly. Allison Porter, who was the daughter or one of the kids in Parenthood, I think is Kevin Kline's daughter in this movie.
She has one line when they have the argument at the diner, right?
Isn't she the one who plays Miss Mary Mack? Which I also like because, I mean, that song is like, it's an earworm in the sense that, like, I'm still thinking it now. And what I love about it in the movie is that for the next, like, 3 or 4 scenes, like, Kevin Kline is singing that to himself as he's walking around, like this... You know, this little, like, rhyme or whatever he's playing
with
his daughter just
words.
Can't get it out of his head.
It's Mary Mac, Mac, Mac at the disco, tack, 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 and I'm looking at her, right down on her back, 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 and I'm when I will come back.
Heather Graham's going to return and even Cowgirls Get the Blues. I feel like there's been a couple different people who are going to return in that movie, so that's sort of going to be a reunion of sorts for Keanu Club. This is the first River Phoenix Keanu movie. He'll be back in My Own Private Idaho. He met Keanu. He was just hanging around on set because he was dating Martha Plimpton from Parenthood. And obviously he's the older brother of Joaquin Phoenix. And so he was just sort of on there and they became friends and they made this movie together. I don't know if one got the other involved or what. And then while filming this movie, they apparently met and started talking to Gus Van Sant. And that's when that's sort of what led to My Own Private Idaho coming out the next year. Mike, any other last thoughts?
Yeah, we don't really pick up too much on like the music in these movies as much, but I really enjoyed what I haven't heard in a long time since like the early 90s, late 80s, which is steel drum on the score. It opens up with like this really nice, feels very 80s to me from what I remember, but you could hear the steel drums. And I also remember hearing them in like 80s action films as well, you know, like Commando. And so I was a little upset when the score kind of drops out for most of the movie, but I do like the music that we do get here.
Well, thank you very much, Lindsay, for joining us. You'll be back in a couple episodes for a much shorter episode about Paula Abdul's Rush Rush video, so that's kind of exciting. So,
thanks
but thank you for joining
me.
Us for I Love You to Death. And I know that you loved it, I loved it, and hopefully one day
this
Mike will find it in
it
his heart
lot.
To love this movie too.
Well, I like it to death. I'll say that
okay.
right.
There you go. So for all things Keanu Club, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub. You can find out what we've done already, what we're doing next, all sorts of fun stuff. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Lindsay Gibb, and we'll see you next time on Keonic Club.